And a very good morning to you. This is the Tuesday edition of Down to Brass Tacks, 4341790. 266-4862 is our WhatsApp connection. BrassTacks@starcomnetwork.net for your emails. The way is you can reach us. I'm Dennis Johnson, your host. We go until 2 o'clock. At the controls, taking care of things technical, John Stout. And he'll be answering the calls, making sure that we stay on the good, straight, and narrow as we go through today's edition. It's been a while since I've sat behind the microphone, and so much has happened since then. Let me start, of course, by extending condolences to the family, friends, colleagues, political and otherwise, of former Prime Minister Right Honourable Owen Arthur. Yesterday we had a day of tributes, listened to some of his colleagues, political and school friends. Did not hear some voices I would like to have heard from who have associated with Prime Minister Arthur, former Prime Minister Arthur over the years, John Williams being one of them. Every time I seem to have seen Mr. Arthur on more than one occasion, especially in the supermarket, John would be part of his entourage. The other person is the guy called the B-Man, Mr. Gibson. Would see them in conversation from time to time if I drifted around that area. It would be interesting to hear their recollections. I'm going to try to reach out today to colleague Peter Wickham in France, because I haven't heard Peter on this, and there's a particular question I'd like to ask Peter as well. Because politics in the Caribbean is in an interesting place. You have a Guyana election still undecided, Trinidad and Tobago going to the polls in August. The prime ministers of Grenada and St. Vincent, Drs. Ralph Gonzalez, St. Vincent, and Keith Mitchell in Grenada, seeming to signal that they're coming to the close of their political careers. Gaston Brown in Antigua seems to be at loggerheads with his CARICOM colleagues. And I don't think Jamaica has an interest in the CARICOM movement anymore. So I want to ask Mr. Wickham, with the passing of Prime Minister Owen Arthur and with Caribbean islands having citizenship by invitation, something my daughter calls recolonization by invitation, whether we're seeing the end of CSME and whether the Caribbean, especially with COVID being on the minds of so many of those dealing with the economies of the Caribbean. But that's my Caribbean politics. The other thing that concerns me is the continuing level of violence in the Caribbean, especially gun violence in Barbados. In addition to all the other deaths, I don't think that's one that we actually need. And then, of course, the social unrest in the United States, it reminds me of the period of the 1960s, early 1970s, when I started my awareness of the Black consciousness movement and the struggle for equality and recognition of people of color. And it is perhaps one of those strange twists of fate that in the midst of the uprising, one of the final pillars, I think, in the Martin Luther King revolutionary period goes to his final resting place, and even that causes some disagreements in the United States. But that's what I read and spent a lot of time reading over the period I was not here, and trying to wrap my mind around some of the things that have been happening in and around the region. As you grow older, I suppose you get to that strange place in life where you look back and wonder how far you've come. To reach pretty much nowhere, in a sense. Brass Tacks, good morning.
Good morning, Dennis.
Hi.
Dennis, good morning. It's good to hear your voice, and I'm glad that you're back out fighting the good fight. Dennis, I would just like to say this morning to pass all my condolences to the Arthur family, and this is from me, myself, and my brothers, who were very close to Oenata. And I would say that this thing took me by a shock. And I probably would be the last person, probably the last person that had a deep conversation with Arthur the morning before he took ill. And there were a couple of things that he had left with me in a deep conversation. And it was kind of strange that he went into some, speaking of things, and I really don't want to go into in depth what he said to me, but he was very concerned about West Indies cricket.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very concerned about the West Indies cricket.
That we lost again this morning is certainly not a pleasant sight.
Uh-huh. I'm sitting right in front of the television, Dennis.
Don't do that. That's not good for the spirit.
And he was very deep and saddened about the death of Sir Everton Weeks, because Mr. Arthur was very close to Sir Everton. He made a point with me that this guy retired from Test cricket in 1958. And he, Mr. Arthur, made sure he became a knight, gave him his knighthood in 1995, a year after he was Prime Minister of Barbados. They were very close friends, very close friends. Mr. Arthur is... People speak of the economy side of Mr. Oenata, but people didn't understand the historic side of this guy as someone who was deep in history. And whenever you go into a conversation with Mr. Arthur, he would always go into deep depths about speaking of the history of not only West Indies cricket, of politics in the Caribbean. He was a massive lover of Hollis Liverpool Chartists. I mean, sometimes I felt that I had known most of Chartists' music. Mr. Arthur would have put me on a shelf that I could not believe this guy was a massive lover of. He felt that Chartists' writings over the years was excellent for Caribbean unity, integration. If you go back to Chartists' song, Seawater and Sand, mm-hmm. he felt that it was a song written for the times. And it's really difficult to deal with this because, as I said, he took ill on about 3 o'clock the day, and I would have been in a conversation with him speaking about Sir Everton Weeks' funeral, where he was made honorary pole bearer at that particular about the funeral, which is taking place on Thursday.
Mm-hmm. Right, you know, before you move on to that, and I just wanted, I listened to you on the question of his love for Calypso, of talking to you about Calypso, and I felt a tinge of envy, because I tried unsuccessfully for years to get Owen Arthur to sit on fireworks with me. I had the pleasure of almost every other minister of culture, and Glenn Murray was part of the Arthur cabinet, and culture was one of the things he actually spoke to me about on fireworks. But every time I tried to get Prime Minister Arthur to talk about Calypso on fireworks, he would tell me, "Man, come to breakfast, let's talk about my kitchen garden or something." He would change the subject completely. So it was interesting to hear you say that he actually talked about Calypso, because he wouldn't talk to me about it at all. But the other interesting thing about this, the point you made about people talking about one side of a person. Yesterday, listening to Sir David Simmons, for example, here too is another gentleman with a deep love for West Indies cricket and music, especially calypsos. I think Sir David must have one of the most rivaled calypso compilations. Anyway, he revels in the cultural sound of the Caribbean. And I think it is unfortunate that so many people see these gentlemen from their political or perhaps their professional lives only. But anyone who knows Owen Arthur would tell you that you don't disturb him when he's sitting down under a tree looking at cricket. Unless the sky falling.
I think the only person that could disturb Owen Arthur sitting on the tree watching cricket would probably be Glenn Murray. Very close friend of Mr. Arthur. Very, very close friend. I just want to make this point. Most people see Mr. Arthur as the Prime Minister of Barbados. But when I got close to this guy never never discussed that he's been prime minister. He was a very modest person in everything he did, the way he spoke to people, Mr. Arthur, and he was a tremendous person, But I'm going to make one point here, and I didn't really want to be drawn into this whole scenario about the statue of Lord Nelson. But I would say to Barbadians, we have the perfect person to replace Lord Nelson in Hero Square. Mr. Arthur was the architect behind the 10 national heroes, and this is my part that I would like to say, that Owen Seymour Arthur, whenever the Prime Minister of Barbados have a discussion with her cabinet, social partners, whatever the case may be, Adrian Bailey would like to see Mr. Owen Seymour Arthur be the person to be erected at Hero Square, where Lord Nelson is standing. As I said, I would never call the programs to discuss these sort of topics. I normally call the programs to discuss cricket.
This guy was
a colossal to Barbadians. His first cousin, Elliot Dugling, Dr. Elliot Dugling, can discuss cricket for lengthy hours. And I said, one day I felt I had worn up on Mr. Arthur when I told him about Three Blind Mice by Hollis Liverpool. Barra, Marley, Burnham. He tell me, Mr. Bailey, he called the year it was written, the outfit Mr. Hollis Liverpool. So I said, listen, I backed off. The only thing I'd ever hold Mr. Arthur with was Lawrence Roe 302. I had one on him. And he tell me, well, you got this one. He excellent brain. I would have loved to see him go on at least for 10, 15 years, but the Almighty have made a decision, and he's going to the great beyond, and I know Barbados have lost a great man.
Thank you very much, sir. When the umpire raises the finger, that's one finger you can't see are not coming in right now. 4341-790, Brass Tacks, good morning.
Good morning, Dennis. This is Glenn Murray.
Good morning, Glenn. Good to hear
you. How are you doing, sir?
A lot better, Glenn. Thank you. A lot better.
Good. Glad to hear you back on the air and bring your inimitable style to the airwaves. I first of all, I want to thank you, Dennis, and VOB for giving me the opportunity to say a few words about the late Owen Arthur. In doing so, I would first of all like to publicly extend condolences to his wife, Julie, daughters, his brother and sisters, and for myself and my family. I would like to first start by saying that so many things have been said about Mr. Owens after so far in just over 24 hours, that there is not much I can say. It is already established his great intellect, his hard work, his vision, his dynamism, etc. I'd like to say a few more things about him as a practitioner. I work with him very close and he practice his politics. I'd like to sum it up by saying that, first of all, that from the time I met Owen Arthur in about 1981, 82, he has had a love affair. It can only be described as a love affair, a massive love affair with Barbados and Barbadians. Love affair that knew no ends, and that no matter the fluctuations in his political fortune, his love of Barbados, commitment to Barbados, and to the people of Barbados never wavered, never once fell short of what I'd known him from the early days. And I first met him through Tom Adams, and like what some of the things I've heard said that Mr. Arthur, that Tom Adams selected him from Jamaica. What I recall is that he came back to Barbados. He was working in the Ministry of Finance as a budget analyst or something like that. And Mr. Adams, as Minister of Finance, had occasionally sent him a file dealing with a project for Barbados. I think it might have been the Bridgestone Fisheries Project, and asked for his analysis of it. And his analysis was so rigorous, he tore it to pieces, showed some of the flaws in the original proposal, that I'm told Mr. Adams physically walked to his, well, got up, took the file, and walked to Mr. Arthur's office and said, "You have to meet the man who wrote this." And that began their relationship. And that laid the foundation for his having said that Mr. Arthur's nomination for the first by-election in St. Peter in 1984, he had one of the finest brains of the 20th century. And I think current events, subsequent events, have certainly lived up to match Mr. Adams' judgment and foresight in selecting him. He, if I might say a bit further about the first St. Peter by-election, it is the first St. Peter by-election in 1984. Mr. Adams was not as deeply involved in as the second. The first by-election was managed basically by some national figures so there was not the hand-to-hand day-to-day involvement of those managers as was required in the second by-election. When he lost the first by-election by one, and then Mr. Adams decided he wants, when he had analyzed the events, the figures and events and some of the things that transpired during the campaign, Mr. Adams, took a more hands-on day-to-day action along with Mr. Adams. And that was the basis for him. And after that, after he won in 1984, he spent the next nearly 2 years getting to know St. Peter on the ground, going to every cricket ground, every domino table, going to every dance, every fair. I get to establish a relationship with people. And it was on that basis then that he was able to withstand that massive swing in the election of 1986 when we were decimated and went only to 24-3. Okay. Now a very demanding boss, a very demanding manager, because he wanted perfection, the highest standards. But he was not a micromanager. If he gave you a task, once he was sure of your competence, your judgment, unless something untoward happened or you heard something, he never called you every day, every night to get them to actually manage the project. He would depend on your reports, how you kept him up to date based on your... Certainly that was my experience. Once I gave him up to date based on my judgment, where it was necessary, never had a problem with it. But he call you any hour of the day or night. Any day, any night. If you wanted to check on something with you, if you wanted to follow up on something, if you wanted to give you an idea, if you wanted to discuss an idea. And he was not really out until when he spoke to him, probably about 4 or 5 days before, about 3 days before he went to the hospital. We discussed all kind of issues. But that apart, he was, and one of the hallmarks of him was, and he was an exceedingly accommodating and humane man, despite how he might, his political rhetoric and how strong and vigorous and defiant he might be in his political debates and whatnot, which is all part of the art of political theater. He was, like I said, an exceedingly humane man. And this first came to mind when after we won the election in 1994, we had the question of the staff at Elara Court had to be dealt with. There were about 20 people, the 18-20 people who were either working in the house or were on the grounds. And the tradition had been that when there's a change of government, or even a change of prime minister, the staff had just moved completely or changed or transferred, etc. Mm-hmm. He said, no, leave them alone. It is not, they shall not lose any jobs because it is not their fault that a government changed. That is democracy, and they should not be victims of politics unnecessarily. And he assigned me the task of finding a job for everyone living in government. First of all, there was a decision as to who you would like to stay, and then to give people an option whether they want to stay or where they want to go. And those who want to go, or those who had to go, were placed in government, in government departments or government institutions, so they never lost any salary, never lost any benefits. And some of the staff could not believe it because they expected the worst. And therefore he felt, and therefore when he brought in this new policy, this more humane, broad-based policy, they were flabbergasted, but exceedingly pleased.
Before you move off of that, Glenn, that is one of the things I wanted to ask you about. What you called the humane side of Owen Arthur, because listening again to the political and members of parliament and the political side of Owen Arthur, there are two things I recalled about Mr. Arthur. And one of them was the curious case of a gentleman by the name of Victor Hinkson.
Right.
Whenever I saw Mr. Arthur in his prime ministerial days, there would be this elderly guy walking around behind him with papers or a briefcase. I remember him once coming to the studio to do a program. I was a producer at the time. And the gentleman came and sat next to us in the production booth, introduced himself. And that's when I met Mr. Hinkson. He would call from time to time. And people kept asking, what was this guy doing? What was his job? Why, you know, what was he? I remember one day somebody, I think in the political crosstalk, asked Mr. Arthur, and he made the comment that he had given him the job, if you want to call it that, because he couldn't survive on his pension. So he was basically giving him something to do to keep him alive and working. And I thought that was a curious statement for a politician to make, because those are the kinds of openings that your political opponents would find a soft spot to drive a knife in.
But there's more to that. There's another story for the deficiency of Mr. Hinkson's pension. Mr. Hinkson had been an employee of the CARICOM secretary for many years, the public affairs officer, etc. And when he retired from the secretariat, they were being paid in Trinidad dollars or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And
the exchange rate would kill them.
Right. He landed in Trinidad the same day the dollar was devalued, and he could not get to the bank to switch it to U.S. dollars. So he got a very paltry sum out of his CARICOM experience. But in addition to that, it was a fact that in 1986, Mr. Hinkson was at CBC.
Mm-hmm.
And when the government changed, I think he needed about 5 more days to qualify for national insurance or something like that. And the political director refused to let him work for 5 more days. So here's a man who lost heavily in Trinidad through no fault of his own at the CARICOM concert. Now comes to Barbados to lose again. And so he was basically trying to make for that when Mr. Arthur, he was Mr. Arthur's personal assistant.
Press officer or something?
Yeah, he was press officer also. So Mr. Arthur quite rightly felt that he's very hard done by circumstances of his own. And therefore, when they saw him do that for the staff at LRCO, I remember Mr. Hinkson, right? And there was a total contrast. So that therefore laid the basis. He said basically felt that everybody should live. That was his basis for everybody should live. And therefore, when he went into the realm of policies of inclusion, it was not just a Machiavellian move to try to decimate or destroy. Or we can
really?
I tell you. Even within the party, there were people who had been not very endeared by him. The fact that he had exceeded them in getting to be prime minister, leader of the party, prime minister, whatever. But what he believed in, find even your biggest opponent, find a role for that person. Give them something useful and make use of those skills.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why you see some of the persons who might have been behind the scenes rivals. He found roles for them.
But isn't that a clever way of undercutting your what you see as being your greatest opposition, turning a weakness, a perceived political weakness, into a political strength? Because behind it all, the image I have of him is someone who understood the use of political power. So there are times when you have to use it benevolently, and there are times when you have to use the iron fist, if you want to call it that.
Well, okay.
And you were closer to him, so you would have perhaps known better than I which way it was used.
That is a fair question. My experience is that he never expected that by doing that he would change their hearts.
Okay.
But he, believe me, because there's some people who can't be changed. And he never thought, he would never to them, you know, play up to them and get their, he gave them a job and left them to do it or not do it. Even when, for example, when on occasion you have a fair minister who was a lawyer,
mm-hmm.
he came to cabinet the next few days and said, ladies and gentlemen, this minister is no longer with us, but this minister is a lawyer, and the minister has to live. Again, he has to live. We have to make sure that when government work is being distributed in the legal profession,
that gets
some of that work, not all, some of that work, because that minister, though dismissed, still had to live. So So, I mean, I've seen enough examples of it that he, to let me know that he, that was a genuine preoccupation of him in that role. Don't forget, he himself had had a struggle, you know.
But, and this is the political side that I wanted to hear from you, Glenn, because I know you were, you worked closely with him on several issues. I mentioned earlier that you represented him in the cultural ministry when I wanted someone of fireworks. The thing about what you've just said is this. It therefore enforces the belief that some people have that government largesse is distributed to those who hold power believe that it makes them beholden to them somehow. And even though you may say that their reason for doing so is above board and altruistic, it gives the public the impression that they are the chosen few who get the fatted calf.
But you remember I said, when the government's legal work was distributed to the legal profession, not to the BLPA or lawyers.
Yeah, I understand
or
that.
Law firm. So mm-hmm. It's a general distribution, and therefore if it's a general distribution, that person, he did not say, let us therefore give the most or 10% that person make for any shortfall. Let them share. The political patronage is a fact of life in all societies. All. And I learned over the years that in the same way, there's some people who might be anxious to get a job at NCC or the Transport Board or one of the corporation, SAS. They are professionals, lawyers, engineers, accountants, etc., who because of the size of government and the amount of services government seeks and provides, they can only survive if they get a part of that of that largesse, of that patronage of the government services, because it's a service to the community. They get a part of that too. So it's not corruption. It really is not corruption.
No, I didn't call it that. I talked about the public perception that if you're close to the government, you will get the gravy. It's a perception that I think it's not a Bajan perception. Let me put it that way. It's a perception that's attached to politics the way we do it in the Caribbean. You find that certain names come up over and over and over again. For example, we have the Chief Justice resigning at, you know, in a few months. And look at the names that are called as possible replacements. And tell me if they don't seem aligned to the politics of, you know, a particular group of people. And the question then is asked, are there not others who are equally possessed of the qualities one would like to see in a Chief Justice? And why aren't those names mentioned?
But from what I saw in the paper, the names mentioned were names
across the board
by the reporter who interviewed us.
Right, and this is why I said...
In all fairness, the government was a government-nominated...
Agreed.
...government nomination list.
Glenn, you're getting my point. The public perception is what I started to say, and that's why I went to that, because it is a perception. Whether it's pushed by the opposition, whether it's pushed by the media, it's a public perception that comes to the fore all the time.
And I think some of it is, like you said, about the legal work, et cetera, and the distribution of patronage. Some governments do go overboard and virtually sort of monopolize it, as we've seen in recent years in one particular firm, or nearly a few firms. but it is something that it will depend on the judgment, on the philosophy, on the attitude of the prime minister of the time, who has to determine how far this patronage will extend and to whom and in what manner and whatnot.
And how much it would upset the party.
Yeah. The point is too that the reality is that some of this, given our political system, given the context in which how we finance elections, parties need patronage. That's why it is connected.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you have to give people, you have to give firms a chance, even some of the big construct firms, a chance to make money so that they too can give something in the kitty, the only way you would avoid that would be to change the method by which we
finance political parties.
Right,
and that is one of the challenges, I think, going forward in the Caribbean, that we have to look at the whole structure, I think, of parties and governments in particular, because looking throughout the Caribbean, I started talking about the current state of what I call I think the collapse of CSME is the only way I can put it gently. Because outside of Mr. Arthur, now deceased, you have uncertainty in Guyana. You have running for office in Trinidad. One person said Trinidad is not the Caribbean ATM when they were in office. You have Drs. Gonzales and Mitchell seemingly on their way out. St. Lucia is ambivalent. Jamaica is not concerned. And you have Antigua, who just had a little noise with both Barbados and St. Vincent. Who supports this regional integration now? Who? Where's the future?
But where the financial or political election accounts is concerned.
So that's who's calling the shots. The people who write the checks.
I think the coronavirus will change that. Because the way of the will force a change. I hope so. Because after some of the excess I saw in recent elections, mm-hmm. I think it was obscene almost the amount of money that was shared around or floated around or utilized by providing fed and food and shirts and all kind of other political paraphernalia to people. I think it was excessive. And I therefore think that because I've already heard a member of the governing party talking about the finance, looking at the finance of political elections, I'm saying, and I think that because of the way that the virus has damaged the community, the society, and the economy, there won't be really much left to distribute. And therefore, that is probably going to force people to go back to a more modest way of running elections, first of all. I think we've become far too Americanized and indulging a lot of excessive behavior that don't really count and matters any better for society. Right? So therefore, I think that will force us. Because the money's not there, you can't buy these things. I mean, in my life, I've been amazed to see how the whole culture of electioneering has changed. What you're supposed to do, the excess. And not only that, but the public has also seen a change in the fact that in early days I saw where people volunteered in a campaign. And you only probably get something for working on election day when you're tallying votes and working at the polling station. Nowadays, once there's an election on, every man expects to be paid for every. It's an industry. Mm-hmm. Election is an industry, and therefore you need the money to fuel that. So some of the supporters are not, like you said, motivated necessarily by altruistic
reasons.
Factors. They're looking after their own. Looking after what is in it for me also.
Well, let me just ask you this as we wrap this conversation up. Let me swing it to current events. Your thoughts on the reshuffle?
That's
a back of the hand ball.
That is something I do probably in my next step.
Okay.
I like to do it.
No problem.
Before I go there, I just want to say that we still yet will have to think about how to fully evaluate Mr. Arthur's contribution to Barbados. Mm-hmm. And my major regret is that I know he had been working on his memoirs. Mm-hmm. I remember Tom was on his tally on his before he died. And again, I was really hoping that, because there's some issues which I will probably talk about in the future, that I would love to have as a detailed insight presented as to why he did certain things, or why he did them certain way, and how it affected people and whatnot.
Well, I thank you for sharing with us, Glenn. There's one in particular that I recall that I would like to have heard his input on as well, but it's too late for that now. And that was when he moved at the HIV/AIDS portfolio, if you want to call it that, from the Ministry of Health to the Ministry of Finance, because he said the HIV/AIDS pandemic was an economic issue and not a health issue. And now we're seeing the same thing with COVID, that it's economic as well as health. But I remember being the moderator at an event where he asked two questions. There was supposed to be a question tree, and the people were supposed to write the question, post it on the question tree, and they would hand it to the moderator, and you would ask, and the person to whom it was directed would answer. Everyone had yellow post-it notes. Mr. Arthur had a pink one, and he wrote with a fountain pen, which most people don't write. The first question was, will the Prime Minister, in an effort to assist with the HIV/AIDS fight, take the VAT off of condoms? And I asked the question, and he responded. The second question was, will the Attorney General, in an effort to fight the HIV/AIDS pandemic, introduce condoms into prison. Well, the Attorney General answered, and thereafter there was a great hue and cry and shouting all over Barbados, and Bajans were asked to cease and desist and cease and settle. And it was interesting who raised the question. It was one of those political moments that I recall. Never got a chance for him to answer it, but I saved the two post-it notes, and I recall it was one of the things I wanted to raise. But it's one of those moments in Caribbean political history that perhaps when I write it will be there, I don't know. (4341) 790-266-4862, brasstacks@starcomnetwork.net, and you can also join us on Zoom. Good morning, and thank you very much for holding.
Hello, good morning, Mr. Johnson.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, how are you?
Yeah, I'm not bad, sir. How are you?
Mr. Johnson, a couple of things there. Normally say a couple, but sometimes it leads to two or three.
Correct.
The first thing, right, the first thing, Mr. Johnson, you've got to laugh sometimes and smile to yourself about what some of these cricket commentators, when they are asking questions and when they're talking. I remember the same Barry Wilson, Rickerson, Andrew Mason, when they had a guest on Mason guest. When the West Indies won the first test match, it was said that we could go on now and beat England and retain the trophy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, after the second test match, one of the same commentators came on the TV, CBC TV, and said that the reason is that the boys need to get climatized.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the first test match, when they won, they were not talking about climatizing, you know. But after the second test match, we need to get climatized.
Sir, you see, here's the problem.
Uh-huh.
England is not Kensington. There are several counties. There are different types of climatic conditions. So batting at Edgbaston is not the same as at Lord's, is not the same as, you know, somewhere else. You have different weather conditions. You have ball that swings and turns because of atmospheric conditions. You got to get accustomed to the place you're playing. That's what they mean by acclimatized.
Well, I let's agree to disagree.
Well, we usually do.
Listen, so nothing strange. This is the thing. If you are won the second test match, you will never hear a talk about climate.
No, I can't say that because I don't know what they would say.
Oh, okay.
You see, that's the conclusions you jump to that I don't jump to. That's why we usually agree to disagree.
Right. That's why I want to bring home now.
Mm-hmm.
So when you ask Guy Murray about the reshuffling of the cabinet,
mm-hmm.
and I heard the Satman told Peter last week that is a strategic move.
Mm-hmm.
My question to you, mm-hmm. based on what? If you're going to tell me that...
Based on what?
Yeah. That you move people, they are already more than, and put them in the back bench, and tell me it's a tricky move. Based on what?
So, based on the fact that a government has to do two things. One, it has to prepare for the future. Two, it has to deal with the present. So, when you get to the halfway mark in your term in office, a prime minister usually looks at what has been done, mm-hmm. what is to be done, who's performed, who's not performed, what are the opportunities that you could give to new blood to give them a better chance in the next election, mm-hmm. how many people you think will not be around for the next election. So that's the strategy. You sit and you strategize and say, okay, if we're going for a second term, who do I need to put where to ensure that, one, I keep the progress that we've made, or I make new progress, or I find a way to win the next election starting now.
Okay.
That's what strategy means.
Okay. Let me base my take on statistics now.
Fine.
Whatever. That is, okay. Mm-hmm. Based on last year, the murders were 49. I talk about the murders. This include gun murder, knife murder, colleague's murders, 49. This year so far, there are 25. When the Barbies, their party first took office, by that time to December, they had around 10 murders. If you count that, what are the total numbers of murders since the Barbados Labour Party took office, sir?
I ain't counting, but go ahead, tell me.
But it's around 84 murders,
mm-hmm.
all right? In a period of 2 years. Now, based on those numbers,
mm-hmm.
why was not the attorney removed from office, sir?
Sir, because the office of the police. The police moved from the Ministry of Home Affairs to the Attorney General. Perhaps the Prime Minister, in her judgment, thinks that he's not having enough time to make a contribution. And who knows, she may move it back to the Ministry of Home Affairs when the throne speech is made. You know what she's going to do?
But so I can assume then, by now an election time, we will be close to 200 murders.
So you could make whatever. So you could make whatever estimate you want to make based on whatever you want to make it on.
But
I can't support you on that.
But are you satisfied?
With what?
With the amount of crime and murders that we are having.
You didn't hear me say just now that the murder situation in Barbados is alarming to me, sir?
No, I didn't hear you say that.
Oh,
before.
You see, because there are some things that you hear and some things you don't hear. That's all right. I understand that. But, you know, sir, if there's anybody in Barbados who's not concerned about the spate of murders or violence in general, I don't think they live in Barbados. I think the level of domestic violence, the level of gun crime, the level of disregard for human life, let me put it that way, is alarming. And I made this statement more than once since I've been here this morning. Not only locally, I spread it to regionally, and I even mentioned the fact that the United States was going through the mess they're going through. And it reminds me of the 1960s and the struggle for the recognition of the black man. So you missed that part. But as I said, sometimes you don't hear. Thanks for your contribution. Brass Dex, good morning. So, all right, let's roll that and see if I could get someone to have a conversation. Brass Dex, good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Johnson.
Morning, sir.
Yeah, I want to make two comments. Mm-hmm. First, I want to make a comment as regarding the displeasure that I would say suffered yesterday in respect to a call I made.
Sir, don't do it. Don't do it. Trust me, don't do it. Trust me on that. Don't do it. Have a good morning, sir. 4341790. Let me just read this WhatsApp to you. Can someone please find out for me if the welfare office on Roebuck Street is open to the public yet? The office in my area refused to accept me. Thanks in advance. And the second one said, I've been laid off since March. I'm on my second green paper. I've not received any unemployment since April. Can VOB please ask the NIS what is really going on with the checks, rent, food, etc., has to be paid, bought, things with no money.